House Committee on Elections and Rules, this Cinco de Mayo, will come to order. This time we'll open a public hearing on HJR 51. Call forward Senator Jason Atkinson and Representative Dennis Richardson. Cletus, if you'd please read the measure.
Chair and Committee, HJR 51 proposes amendment to the Oregon Constitution to require legislative assembly to pass bill funding public schools by the 81st day of regular session and to prohibit compensation of legislators if bill is not passed. Refers proposed amendment to the people for approval or rejection at the next general election.
Thank you, Cletus. Senator, Representative, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Go ahead.
For the record, Jason Atkinson, State Senator for a big chunk of Southern Oregon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Let me begin by saying that this is my favorite committee of all time and places. I started in the House in the Rules Committee, and I've stayed on the Rules Committee all the way through. I think it's those of you who are new to the process are about to, I hope, enjoy it as much as I am at the end of session. So,
you never should have done it with your kids, so that might change.
I have served, Representative, under some fairly colorful chairman, but no, I have not had the privilege to serve Representative Coates.
My compliments, Chair.
Let me begin this discussion by first of all thanking my good friend and my state representative, Dennis Richardson, for reintroducing this bill in the House. Let me also thank Chairman Kitts for giving this bill a hearing and for all of your indulgence for allowing me to bring it to you. Again, one of my favorite things about the Rules Committee is that you actually get your hands on everything at the end of session, and I'm pleased to bring this to you today. This bill mirrors another bill that I was running in the Senate. And the basic nuts and bolts of the bill is this will be a constitutional referral to Oregonians to pass the K-12 budget within 81 days. And if that is not done, politicians lose their pay. Or if the governor, whoever that may be, decides to veto the bill, if they veto the bill, then the clock starts on 2 weeks. 2 weeks rotate until we can pass the bill again. Let me tell you foremost, from my years here now, that I believe that the system of higher education or of K-12 funding is fundamentally broken. I think that regardless of who you are and where you come from and what party you're in, I don't think anyone in this legislative assembly can agree or would argue that we do things right on K-12 in this building. I don't think anyone here would agree that it works very well. It has been my experience in all these years to see a governor, regardless of party, but a governor puts out a very low number in January, as constitutionally required, and then they walk away from that number. The legislature then slugs it out, and everybody gets votes for the next campaign cycle, and we all delay and delay and delay, and you wait till the May forecast, or the March forecast, and then the May forecast. Everybody drags their feet on the off chance that we might actually get a budget. And if you look on your SMS, second paragraph, you'll see last session it was actually completed 226 days into session we had a K-12 budget. The session before that, 181 days. The session before that, 187 days. Other states around us, Idaho, Washington, larger states, Utah, Florida, can pass their entire budget in 60 days, but yet we as Oregonians, the largest budget that we pass, arguably our mortgage payment, is the last bill to pass. Now, there's none of you that pay your groceries, buy clothes, take your family to the movies, go out to dinner, and then pay your mortgage payment. All of us on the rest of Oregonians has to prioritize spending. That's what this bill does. Now, every politician in the building, House, Senate, Republican, Democrat, urban, rural, we'll all campaign that education's our priority, but yet nobody can break the broken system. That's why this bill seeks to put in the Constitution. This binds future legislatures to come to this building in January and get working. Now, Senator Atkinson, people will say, we don't want to have this be cut education first. Education funding, we all know, if you all take away any partisan look at this. Just look at it as an Oregonian. We know that the number is not going to go down. Senator Atkinson, we just got to wait till the May forecast, the March forecast, because we'll get more money. And I'm here to tell you, as someone who's been here for a while, is that odd to say, Representative, that that number and those forecasts have never made a dime of difference. It's deafening to me to know that the education lobby has not helped out on this bill. In fact, only one member of the OEA has actually been into my office interested in the concept. But what this does is this actually fundamentally breaks up the monopoly that of delay in this building. I think it's not only good government, not only responsible and accountable, but the other thing is, colleagues, the black eye that this body has in the out in the rest of Oregon, the legislature has got. We earned it. We earned people's mistrust. And so what this bill also seeks to do is say we're going to get here, we're going to get to work, and I think it goes a long way to helping the institution of the legislative branch show not only, one, are we serious, number two, we get here to work, and number three, we're going to get it done first. I would be delighted to answer any questions. I've got no notes. This is nothing but passion. When I ran the bill in the Senate, it was just my name on it, and people said, well, that's because he's some big-headed. Nah, that had nothing to do with it. The problem is, if I had Republicans on it, Democrats would hate it. If I had all Democrats and just me on it, then Republicans would hate it, and I don't see this as partisan at all. And so as you look today, that is the intent. The only thing I can offer you is a word that I refuse ever to campaign on, which is experience. It's odd to think that I've been here this long, but I've never seen the system, not the number, the system fixed. We beat around the bush all the time. Everybody running for office, we'll beat around the bush and we're going to try to do more money here and hang out a Republican for a vote here and yeah, delay. The system's broken. And that's what I hope this gets to. I'd be delighted, Mr. Chair, to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator. We'll go ahead and let Representative Richardson testify first if he has anything to add, and then we'll take questions at that time.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I bring this bill forward as a priority bill, actually, not just because it needs to be brought forward to assist my colleague and friend, Senator Atkinson, but also because I was a member of the School District 6 Budget Committee and the chair of that committee for a period of time. And we went through the process that's required every March and April and May of going from school to school and holding public hearings, going over the school district's budget without an idea of what that budget's going to be. And as Senator Atkinson has mentioned, in previous session by previous session, education has been held to the very end of the session where it becomes a political football that's passed around to try and utilize political power to get an agenda through, when the reality is that school districts need to know what their budget's going to be so that they can plan contracts that have to be signed, so that they can plan their advertising to try and bring in the teachers that they're going to need and organize a curricula and utilization of facilities. And how can they do that if they don't even know how much money they have until middle or late summer? This bill says, legislature, you're going to have to pass an education budget, so do it within the first 81 days, which is roughly around May 1st, so that the school districts can plan on what their resources are going to be. In some instances, it's even more important to know what they are than to have this hope that they might go up over time, because at least when there's certainty, they can plan accordingly. And without it, there's nothing that they can really do other than kind of wring their hands and say, what if it's this and what if that? This bill goes to the people and asks the people this one question: should the legislature give the school districts a budget by roughly May 1st so that they can plan the following school year? And if you'll pass this out, and if it would make it through both the houses, we will see that the people will respond with a resounding yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. And I'll tell you, as I said earlier today, good to see a concept like this come forward. Honored to have played a role in helping in the small way that I have as chair. It puts teeth behind the talk. So appreciate you. Representative Martin.
Thank you. And Representative Richardson, I appreciate your comments because you mentioned the 81st day as being somewhere around May 1st. I'm looking at the joint legislative schedule for today, May 5th, and according to the official document here, it says 116th day. So there's some clarity, I think, or lack of clarity in this measure.
No, the lack of clarity is in my misspeaking. I should have said April 1st.
April 1st.
Sorry.
So to follow up then, since we're 35 days beyond the date, we should probably each kick in about $1,496.
I got to gavel that down.
Okay.
You're making me break out in a sweat over here, Representative.
Plus per diem.
I read that. Making me nervous.
Mr. Chair. May I comment, Mr. Chair, Representative? Why 81 days? That's a question that constantly comes up. And I have to tell you, the idea, I keep a notepad on my nightstand because that's, you know, if I write it down in the middle of the night and I wake up and it's still a pretty good idea, then maybe. 81 days is actually, when I thought about this, April Fool's Day was the day I wanted, but I thought that was just a little too much. So 81 days is a date. It's 21 days, 3 weeks longer than 60 days. Oftentimes, if you're, and all of you are, a student of the process, will know that some of the states that have a 60-day budget year, budget cycle, I think it was is Idaho that I was always most fascinated with. On the 60th day, they put a black blanket or a black cloth over the clock that struck at midnight, and they'd keep working at two or three extra days just to give them a little more time, or pass a concurrent an extension resolution in 5-day increments. I just believe that if we actually, as a body, and you all know, or most of you know, how interim committees take up a lot of time, but by the time you get here in January, interim committees are forgot about. And so what we do as a legislative body when we can't work out an issue is we have a task force or a work group, and we're going to report to the legislature, and in the end, nothing ever happens. If this bill were enacted, instead of the E-Board being the committee of choice in the interim, it would probably be a budget committee or an education committee, a committee that's going to work all the time to make sure that when that State of the State address is given and we're all done clapping and shaking hands, we go to work. And that's, I think, 81 days, 3 weeks more generous than other states.
Representative Greenlee.
We passed a constitutional amendment a couple of years ago that required us to fund schools based on the quality education budget, and that's in place. We ignored it. We didn't have our salaries attached to it, but we ignored it. I wonder what would stop us from a rather cynical approach. I remember when my kids wanted an answer, and I said, I'm not ready to give you an answer. I'll give you 2 weeks from now. And they said they want an answer now. I said, okay, the answer now is no. But if you want a yes, you're going to wait 2 weeks because I have to X, Y, Z. I mean, I can imagine a scenario. We come in. The governor suggests 5.0. We pass a budget at 4.8. Everybody signs it. And then we come back when we really get to it on the 214th day or the 312th day or whatever it is, pass the final budget and repass the school budget with a different number. Would there be anything in this that would stop us from doing something like that?
That's directed to me. Mr. Chair, Representative.
You're a kind gentleman. Thank you for bringing us this.
Fantastic question. A question that when I was writing the bill, I went around and round and round with legislative counsel and trying to figure out how do you get at that. There's nothing, let me answer it a couple ways. The first way is there's nothing that precludes us from adding back. And the reason for that is more than anything is a safety valve. I mean, if and also politically, for those that believe that we have to have, you know, we have to put all our stock in a political or occasionally non-political revenue forecast, you know, if we're going to wait till the May forecast is more money, add more money back, fine. To me, it's not a number issue for me. It's a process. Do we avoid things that are put does the body ignore things that are done statutorily by initiative? Absolutely. You know, spending limit's another one. I think the problem with the quality education model is it sounds good when you're voting on it, but as you all know, the implementation can be so political that it loses absolute credibility the second that it hits here. As an aside, I voted against the Quality Education Commission simply because as a senator representing people, I don't know if it really, if I believe it as not just another advocacy group. I mean, we all know of all the advocacy groups that are out there, and every advocacy group out there, it's all money related or it's accountability related. It's never process oriented. That's our job. So is that scenario likely? It could be, but the reason why I want it in the Constitution, and I don't care who, every one of you take credit for this, please. Is if we say as a body, as a legislative branch of government, please help us be disciplined. Please help us put some teeth into prioritizing. I think there's an accountability there. So right now there's no accountability, and regardless of party, but the governors traditionally will put out a low number and then they walk away from it. And I've seen that for a few of other governors. So I'm not pointing fingers at this governor. I think that day would be over. I mean, I think if the people of Oregon said and expected, and as Representative Richardson said, all the school boards are going to know that this is going to be either the number or pretty close because we're going to budget on this number. I think the accountability would be there. I love the institution, and I don't believe that even with all 90 of us, that we're going to play games with it if there's teeth on it, like in 81 days. Now, here's another one, Representative, if I could answer this. You can tell I'm a little bit passionate about this. In my caucus, the question came up, well, Atkinson, why are you doing education? Why don't you do, another proposal was, let's do the size of the pie. Let's have the size of the pie out there within 81 days, and then we'll know how much we have to spend, similar to the agreement that was done earlier. Well, here's my problem with that. That sounds wonderful inside this building, but as I tell every freshman group that I talk to in the House, I give this following advice. Please open the windows so that you breathe the air that the rest of Oregon's breathing. The problem with doing a size of the pie thing is nobody in the real world gets that, and nobody believes it. Senator Atkinson, here's the next one. Why don't we do the entire budget in 81 days? Well, again, I want Oregonians to know it's education. Oregonians will understand 81 days. It's a simple concept. People will understand it. But all of you who work inside this building also know that if we got education, if we paid the mortgage payment first, what's the next one to do? The Commission on Asian Affairs? No. Is it going to be light rail? Probably not. Is it going to be Atomicall statue? It's going to be Health and Human Services, and then it's going to be corrections. So we all know if we pass the mortgage payment first, we're going to get to the next two budgets next, and then the rest. So yes, it's a great question. I've wrestled with it, but I think in the end, Representative, I trust my colleagues. We're not going to monkey around.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Dole.
Thank you. Thanks, Senator Atkinson. You on a checkbook? You have a checkbook?
Me?
Yes, sir.
You're not going to ask for something, are you?
Contribution to my school or something like that? No. No.
Yeah, I was thinking the Marimba Band.
The Marimba Band, right, at Bush Elementary, fourth grade. They're trying to raise $500. Inside thing, I guess. You have a checkbook.
Yes.
This is what I was discussing with Representative Richardson earlier today. Do you need anybody to help you make a decision about how much money you can spend next year compared to this year, or to decide that you're going to write your mortgage payment before you're going to go to Cold Stone Creamer to buy ice cream for your kids or something like that?
I have a kid.
Okay.
Do I need somebody telling me how to do that? Absolutely not.
No, because you're in a position to make the decisions about how you're going to spend your money.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question about this bill is, is it a tacit suggestion that, you know, the legislature is incapable of making a decision about how to budget and put the education budget first? I mean, we could put the education budget first. Mm-hmm. We've controlled our caucus. We've controlled the House for 15 years. We could put the education budget first.
Mm-hmm. to respond, Mr. Chair, Representative. If 90 people had to help me balance my checkbook, it would not get balanced the same way every time. That's the point. The point is, if I had to share my checkbook and my spending decisions with a committee of 89 other people, there is no way it would be balanced correctly. I mean, the Richardson bill at Coldstone Creamery would just be off the charts anyway. So it's not a function of an individual. It's a function of a legislative branch of government. You know, to paraphrase Thomas Jefferson, no one's wealth or wife is safe when the legislature's in session. It's very much that it is a, you have to, as a student, you have to appreciate the fact that we've got these three separate but not equal in Oregon branches of government. And the legislative branch of government is so defensive. Think of the last time we ran a purely offensive type of maneuver or offensive type of change through the legislative branch. It's not. It doesn't happen that often. The judicial is separate. The bully pulpit is in the center office, and we essentially run difficult policy, committee-driven, and my favorite paraphrase of Thomas Jefferson is wonderfully sloppy legislation. What I mean by that is everybody's got to give something up in order to get something done. I mean, that's just the legislative branch of government. And so if you want to balance my personal checkbook by a committee of 90 people, it's going to be wonderfully sloppy, but it ain't going to be how I want to manage the books. What I'm saying on K-12 is the fact that our process is broken. It's the process. All of us, none of us are going to be here forever. We're not. We're not going to, you know, I mean, I didn't serve with any of you. And I'm one of the old guys, for crying out loud. The fact, and I'm not here forever. The fact of the matter is, to serve in the legislature is a huge honor. It is a process for us to protect. And this is a fix to our process. That's what I'm saying.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Martin.
Thank you. One of the questions I have about this resolution and the change of the Constitution is to me, it appears to be dealing with more than one subject in terms of, we're talking about, on one hand, education finance, and then on the other hand, we're talking about the powers of the legislature and the legislature's ability to set its own salaries. And have either one of you received any letters or information from legislative council regarding any possible Armada issues or things like that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have not. I've never heard that.
Mr. Chair, Representative March, no, we haven't, but both of these bills have been drafted, but they've been drafted separately. In fact, the wording of this bill is just a little bit different than the Senate because it wanted to tie it down and make sure it dealt only with K-12. But a number of the legislative council attorneys have gone through it in presenting this to us. It's not like, you know, we wrote it and we're just presenting it to you. And so the LC feels comfortable that it's not going to violate the double subject rule because it's already been through their process. They've learned their lesson.
Well, just I know they've put out revision or a amendment before that they had concerns about being revisions. So it's they give you what you ask for, not necessarily what is appropriate. So I still have concerns about it, but we don't need to take it anymore. Thanks.
Representative Thatcher.
Quick comment on doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different answer, definition of insanity and all that. I think this is certainly something worth considering. And I also wanted to ask, just out of curiosity, Idaho, Washington, Utah, and Florida passed their entire budget in 60 days. Do they have annual sessions?
Limited.
Idaho does.
Idaho does. Washington, but they have the, this is a blanket comment, like 3 months one year and 2 months the other. I have changed my position on annual sessions, actually. I don't think anybody would agree that our system of dragging and delaying until August is smart. If you actually took, this is not germane, Representative March, but if you're actually to do like a 60 and a 90, you know, annual session, we'd be here less, and employers and people that, you know, spouses might like us more. But I believe that's correct. But it's amazing to think that the state of Florida can get it done in 60.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, I'd like to respond on that as well. This gives flexibility to our legislature. There was no flexibility provided in Nevada, and so the people passed an initiative and said, you have a biannual legislature, you will terminate it and finish it within 120 days. Your salaries will end after 60 days. You'll sine die after 120 days, period. And that's what Nevada has to live with. This kind of a bill says we have the number one drain in our resources, number one allocation of resources is education. It's about half the budget. And so rather than saying the entire legislative session is going to end in 120 days, it says pass your largest budget in 81 days. That's good policy, and it's good for education. And the result will be that our sessions will be very short after that, because we're already dealing with half the budget. And yet we still have the flexibility that if there are issues of primary concern, we don't have to solve them all in 120 days, but we will have solved the major drain in resources, which is education, early on. And so it gives us flexibility as to when to terminate the remainder of the session. And I would foresee that we will have much shorter sessions if this becomes law.
Senator Axton, I would also beg to differ that I don't know that spending more time with your spouse or significant other would increase their likability of the senator that they're with.
You know, let me add one other comment to that. I think, again, process-wise, we in the last seven sessions or so, when the gavel comes down on education, I think session ends within 3 days.
So
traditionally, it's right around there. I mean, it becomes a Xerox printing issue. I think if all of you, when you're thinking about this, hopefully tonight, you can consider, I believe that if this were done, like this year would have been March 30th, this bill, we would have had a K-12 budget. I think it's very simple to think that under this bill, just again on good government, we should be done by in May pretty safely, maybe the middle, maybe the last of May. And that's including, you know, those of us that lived through the biscuit fires and some of the other crises that have come up.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chairman Dalto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just one brief question on the timeline issue. I noticed that the Health and Human, the Human Services Budget Committee is still accepting public testimony on some of the program areas. And so it's just thinking about how we construct budgets in Oregon, and we start with the governor's recommended budget, and the legislature accepts that when we come into session, and then we basically parse the governor's recommended budget as a foundation, and the co-chairs build on that. I understand that the governor's administrative folks, the DAS starts building the governor's budget in the summer of the year preceding the legislative session, and it takes almost a year for them to build the governor's recommended budget, at least 6 months to perhaps a year to build the governor's recommended budget, which is available, I don't think, in November, shortly after the election. The budget comes out, and then there's the month of December, which is a holiday month anyway. But then the legislature comes into session January. So I don't know how we have the time to do the work on the K-12 budget and maybe you can educate me because I don't serve on Ways and Means, but how we have the time to do the education function and take public testimony, get input, hear from all the districts and hear from all the stakeholders in 81, is it 81 days?
That's correct.
To be able to do that. And one suggestion is start the Ways and Means work earlier or before the session starts, but the agencies are engaged in the governor's budget before then. So as a matter of practicality, could you walk me through that?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, the data that is used to create the governor's recommended budget is presented to him in November. The budget comes out in the first part of December, and then that is basically the same data that is used to begin the process of working on the budget. But in negotiations, you know, if you have 30 days to negotiate something, it gets done in the last week. If you had 6 months, it's the last you know, a couple of weeks. We work with deadlines, and Nevada is actually a good example of what they had to do. They knew that they had to pass all of their budgets and be out of there in 120 days. And so what they did, instead of having the first 30 days, and this is what happens with Ways and Means right now, it's kind of an overview. Our committees aren't even meeting for the first 3 or 4 weeks of a session. And then we have some joint meetings where they kind of let us know what the various ideas are, but we don't really get to work for at least a month. And then, you know, there's just no real hurry. If this were to be in place, then when the gavel falls at the start of a session, we will begin our hearings immediately, and you'll program public hearings, public testimony. You'll have the data. It'll all be set up on an 81-day or probably a 75-day time frame, because it needs to be, you know, worked through both of the systems. You have a little bit of extra time. And so I'm saying that it will take a change in scheduling, but it's not impossible, because we're using the same basic data that the governor uses, with some adjustments. And so it's not a starting from scratch kind of situation. We just would have to organize our time better so that we come out with a result earlier.
Thank you.
May I respond to that real quick, Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, Representative, members of the beloved Rules Committee that I love so much, lend me your ear. A few moments ago, I told you that we have these three branches of government, and the legislative branch of government is enormously weaker than the rest. We are outgunned, Representative. We do not have research staff. We do not have member staff. In fact, don't all of you have green carpet in your office? You do, don't you? You know that carpet is member than four of us that are up here today? Because we don't take care of the building. We don't take care of the legislative branch of government. We never invest in our own process and our own institution around here. We give all the money away because there's always a mouth to feed. There's always some good cause. But the legislative branch of government is weak. Who's our research? Forget what party you're in. Who gives us good research? We have to wait for the agencies to get to the governor's budget, whether you believe it or not. And you got to wait, and you got to wait. And how many of you have always got your questions answered really quickly from an agency? You don't. The process is broken. And so if this bill were in place and we had to have a real interim committee that did real work to get ready for January, bipartisan committee, fine. Fine. I hope this little bill, very simple, very easy to understand, very process oriented, completely shakes the lobby, shakes the walls of this place, and restores some of the integrity back to the legislative branch and gives us a reason to fix our own branch of government. I don't like being weak. I don't like being on the defense. And the budget system here is set up for us to delay and to wait and for special interests to weigh in, for us not to have the right data. There's not one of us that has the same set of numbers when it comes to the education debate right now anyway. $100 million to me is different than $100 million to Representative Greenland. It is. We don't have good research. We're a weak branch of government. That's another speech for another time. But that's the timeline. I hope this shakes the timeline up tremendously.
Mr. Chair, could I just comment on that? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I respectfully disagree that the legislature is a weak branch of government. The legislature doesn't invest in modern carpet. The legislature doesn't invest in the research, a comprehensive research office. The legislature chooses not to put money on large staffs because we put that money out to Oregonians, back to Oregonians, in the form of education spending, in the form of human services spending, and all those important areas that you suggested. To the extent that the legislature is weak is the extent that the legislative leadership in the past, or whoever is getting to make the decisions, decides to be weak. We're not inferior to other branches. We have abilities set forth by the Constitution, in my opinion, Senator. We have responsibilities and abilities set forth in the Constitution. We are making decisions about how we are going to do that. And if we want to do something about holding agencies accountable, then we can do a better job or refocus our efforts or expand our research capabilities or allow us to have further tools to be able to take back that power. But we have exactly the legislature that we have set out for ourselves. And we can change that if we want to. And the reason why sometimes we don't get instant answers from agency people is just that we have 35 members who have a different idea or a different question to ask those agency folks, and they run around during session getting answers to all our questions, you know, especially in the Department of Human Services. So I wish it's not you, Senator. It's everybody that suggests the legislature is weak is why the legislature is weak. We can be co-equal. We can be. Okay. Well, thanks very much. I mean, nobody's paying attention anyway. So
thank you,
I will.
Representative, and thank you, Senator, for your. You can agree to disagree on the weakness or the strength of the legislature, and that is either of your prerogative. Seeing no further questions, we close the public hearing on HGR 51 and open a work session on HGR 51. Any discussion? Representative Dolko.
Excuse me? No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I made my point.
Representative Martin, Representative Nemo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this would actually weaken the legislature. I know the House had an opportunity to pass a education budget earlier. We chose not to take that opportunity. I don't think the Senate, and they could have asked for a bill to pass it out sooner, has done this, and they didn't take that opportunity. I think the reason we're not doing it by the 81st day is because we're trying to do things thoughtfully and carefully in this process. And under the process, we're supposed to determine the needs of the state under the Constitution and then decide how much to spend, and if we're short, we raise money. I think taking the time to determine the needs is appropriate. I'm going to be a no on this. I don't think it's a good picture to put out. Thank you.
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to support this amendment, but not because I really think it's going to ultimately make the huge difference. My impression, if I were in charge of the legislature under this, in this session, I would have said, okay, the governor's 5.0, the House chair is 5.1 something, the Senate chair is 5.3 something. We need to get it out of here so we keep getting paid past 5.0. And when we get to the real budget, we'll add back whatever it's going to take. And it would seem to me that may not be a bad idea, but if, in that case, might force the school districts, in this case, to budget on the basis of the 5.0 budget we passed, even though we're going to tell them it will, in fact, be some larger number. But I do think we have to, I don't think it is a matter of information. We had every school district in the state saying they need 5.4 in order not to be any worse than they are now. And why didn't we just pass 5.4? Well, because we had a different view of what the right number to pass was. And I think if we can get that political fight in July or August, we get that political fight in April. Because, I would just hope that a bill like this doesn't just cause us to subvert the project of the process, which I think if I were the Speaker of the House and I just wanted to make sure my members got paid, I'd vote something cynically and announce that it won't be the final number. We'll do something better than the final number. That's like hanging the black cloth over the clock, which is a very similar process. But I think it's a good discussion, and I'm interested in having it move forward.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none? Yeah. Better do that first, huh?
Okay, make a motion, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move HJR 51 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thatcher moves HJR 51 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Knowing there's no discussion because we just had it, Netta?
Aye.
Netch.
Aye.
Okay.
Aye.
Okay,
Mark. No.
Aye.
Votes aye.
No.
HJR 51 receiving the necessary aye votes will move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, Senator, and thank you, Representative. This time we will open up a work session on HJR 39. Senator Deckert, do you want to come forward?
There he is.
Do you have a copy of the dash? Three amendments. Senator, thank you for your patience.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, if I could, I've had Dr. John, now I'm going to pronounce this, Cassidy with me. He's the new Vice President of Research for Oregon State University. We just recruited him from Ohio State, and he's with me all day today in the back. And
welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome to the pages of the day as well.
So, Mr. Chair, this is not a new issue. Representative Farr and I and Senator Morse, and I've talked to Senator Morse, we have been working with Representative Dalto, who has, I think, the Dash 3 and the Dash 4 amendments. And as my note indicates to you, we like the Dash 1s the most, the 3s the second most, and then, no, the 4s the second most, and then the 3s. And with that, I would just defer to the wise representative from all of Salem, Representative Dalto.
Representative Dalto, you brought forward both the Dash 3s and Dash 4s. Can you explain?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I brought the Dash 3s and the Dash 4s together as options for the panel here today on this bill. Initially, I had thought that I wanted to keep the legislature with an opportunity at least to try to adopt a bipartisan, bicameral plan for the redistricting, for the reapportionment that occurs after the census. And so I drafted Dash 3s to have the legislature have that first opportunity to draft a bipartisan, bicameral plan. And if the legislature were unable to adopt a bipartisan bicameral plan, then the responsibility would fall on the commission created and anticipated under House Joint Resolution 39. I have been struggling with that idea and the idea of just flatly pulling the partisanship out of the process altogether. I drafted the Dash 4s, the Dash 4 amendments, which are, in fact, the Dash 1 amendments, with language in addition that says that the redistricting plan has to be, that's currently enacted, has to be set aside and that the commission has to start from scratch on a new plan. So I offer both of those amendments to the committee with deference to Senator Deckert. If I had to make a motion, I'd probably move the Dash 4s, but I offer to the committee to decide.
Representative Dalto, I think you bring up some good points. With regards to the current redistricting plan, with that language, as I read that language, there is no current redistricting plan. The last redistricting plan that is now law. It is now the way that it is. So it's my understanding that that is not a plan. It has been implemented, so it's no longer a plan. It is the way that it is. So, and it's also my understanding is that when people do these census that come around every 10 years and we look at the population, everything's adjusted, so on and so forth, we then look at the state as a blank map and do redistrict. And if I'm wrong in my understanding of that, then maybe I see the Elections Division is here and the Secretary of State's office is here. If they'd like to come forward and correct me, I just want to make sure that I'm understanding, because that's how I read it and my understanding of the process. So I don't want to make these amendments a moot point. So, John, can you reference that, or Jesse maybe? I don't. Nice punt, Jesse. I like that. No, you're up.
Okay.
You're up. You go ahead. Nice picture in the paper, by the way.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. So how do you like to take another swing at asking the questions?
For me, it's twofold. Number one, it says here, term continues the next legislative, the operative date and the redistricting plan shall, so on and so forth, then goes on to...
Where is that language, Mr. Chair?
It's on page 9 of the dashboard.
Yeah, Representative Dalto has clarified to me. Note to self, read the bill in its totality. It is on the very last page, the very last two sentences of the dash 4. It says, if a commission is appointed under Section 6 of this article in the year 2011, the commission may not use the legislative redistricting plan adopted in 2001 as a baseline for adopting a new redistricting plan. So let me skip my first question since that's obviously been answered. The second portion of my question was, when the redistricting is done, do they take the existing plan or implemented plan, remove those lines and redraw, or do they look at the existing plan and just simply modify?
For this past, I think the answer to your question depends on whatever the state of technology is at the time, but in the past cycle, each county was mailed a fresh set of maps, and the redistricting is done on the basis of census blocks, and the county is expected to take those maps based on census blocks and apply it to whatever mapping system they have to make sure that those new lines and those new districts are accurate within their street mapping system or their voter registration system. And so they essentially, some of them, depending on the state of their technology, may just have to adjust a few lines in order to make it consistent. Some may have to, if there are real drastic changes, sort of throw out the lines that they have and start over.
Thank you. Thank you, John, for clarifying. Senator Decker, what are your thoughts on as Representative Dalto calls it, the legislative first crack at it? Seems like that's the problem you're trying to get away from.
Yeah, I mean, we believe that the nonpartisan commission is the better way to really to do it, and so what I told Representative Dalto is, we could live with it but wouldn't prefer it. I think it's highly unlikely that this body would actually produce a plan. Then we just want to make sure the timelines work. But I really think we're trying to get away from, and the spirit of the bill is to really get it out of and into a commission form, which I think is, on the whole, a better form. We can. The dash fours are fine, though, because I think that's primarily what hopefully the commission would do, but this might provide clarity, frankly, to tell them exactly what we want them to do, which is just what you said, Chair Kitts, and that is look at the state, look at the census, and go forward.
Any other discussion? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in reference to Representative Dalto's amendments, this bill creating a commission to do the redistricting, you would think you wouldn't want to put any kind of limitations on them, and it certainly is up to them whether or not they would use the current plan or as a baseline to go from or not, and so I don't think I'd be in favor of those amendments that would require them to, not look at the current or plan. So I would offer that.
Representative Farr.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure, and let me confirm this with Senator Decker, but I'm not sure that is what Section 6A states. It says they may not use it as a baseline, but they still obviously can use the current district map. They can't use it as a baseline for establishing new districts.
Representative Dalton, is that your understanding?
Certainly my intent. I'm not suggesting that, you know, in certain neighborhoods it wouldn't work to keep the existing plan. Take my district, for example. My district was districted in a very interesting way that combines two portions of Salem that don't have sort of natural, you know, constituencies together. And so the composition of my district, certainly the political composition, could only improve for me with the redistricting plan. But I think that we don't want to have politics to inform the decision making of the commission, and so to set aside the existing plan would be, you could use parts of the existing plan, you know, if the commission determines that that's appropriate, an appropriate bundling of census blocks. But to, you know, take the plan as it is, which I think is an unfair plan, and other people can disagree with me, and that's fine. But my belief is that the plan is an unfair plan that we are operating under right now, as evidenced by several legislators having to have moved out of their own homes or being drawn out of their plans. So that's why I want to start with something fresh. And that's what I think this amendment does.
Representative Fard and Representative Greenlee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that Representative Dalto's point is well thought out, and I think that really, and Representative Dalto, correct me if this is not what your intent is, but I think that what you don't want to have happen is for a commission to just take the district map as it is and then just leave the districts the way they're carved out and extend beyond the district. I mean, you want to be sure that they're really taking a hard look at how best to serve our constituents.
Mr. Chair, that's my intent with this bill.
Representative Greenlee?
Yeah, I have two issues, but I want to ask Senator Decker a question before I get to the follow-up about this issue we're talking about now. In subsection 9...
Oh, Billy.
On both the ones and the fours. Getting a little lost, as I'm sure we all are here. Let's see. It's page 4 of the... page 4 of the ones, of the fours. It's probably around the same page of the ones. It's the same... It's this issue of if the commission fails to adopt the redistricting plan within the time limit provided, it says the legislative assembly shall adopt the redistricting plan by July 1st. I have two questions about that. One is, what if they don't? And the second is this not as a usual action of the assembly that needs to be approved by the governor? Is this that the assembly does it without the governor's ability to sign or veto the plan?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, section line 24 should begin to answer that question.
Which one? The first question or the second?
The first.
Okay, I got the first. I'm sorry. The second question, the legislative assembly passes it. The governor doesn't have a chance to sign or veto it.
Correct.
Representative Holby.
Well, I'm done with this. I'll come back if we have a moment for another one on the issue that Representative Dalto raised.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just on Representative Dalto's amendments, we're supposedly, you know, thinking about moving HJR 39 to give this authority to a commission. And so I guess just fundamentally, to start with, on some of these amendments, you're having the legislature direct, you know, this commission on how we think they ought to do it to start with. That's my issue. If we're going to create a commission to do this and do it nonpartisanly, you just let them do it and not give them prior directions on we think they should throw this baseline out or not. I mean, that's really my only point.
Senator, do you want to respond to that, or is it, I don't know if that's a question, I think it's just more of a point. Representative Greenlee?
Yeah, I'm really back. I wish you could, Senator Decker, give us a little bit of your philosophy between, there are two branches of government involved in this bill and not the third. And I wondered if it's intended to cut the governor out of the balance of power between the legislative assembly and the governor, or between the Supreme Court and everybody else. I mean, the Supreme Court has the ultimate authority here, but it troubles me to leave the governor out. What comes around goes around, and sometimes you'll have legislative branch in one hand, the governor in another party's hand, and you're never going to know who this is going to be in 2011 and 2021 and things like that.
Can you state your question for the senator?
Yeah, I asked him to give us a little philosophy behind the, that's what started, that was the first part of the question, behind why we're cutting one of the branches of government out of this process.
Senator, can you tell us why you hate the governor?
Well, why you hate the governor in 2011?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, like the, I'm not going to touch that first part. not even get close to it. But the spirit of the bill, as you know, is really in, and I think everything, the contents of it leads you to one place, is that really the, these discussions, where they have taken place, has been in this building, and I think where you'll see them take place undoubtedly is in a, at a better process, which is a nonpartisan retired judges commission doing it. And so that is, you have to have some backstops in there, though. I think it's highly unlikely that any of those backstops would actually ever need to be utilized, because if you look at these commissions and how they've operated across the country, they've been highly, highly effective because they're designed to be effective. And you get, and in many ways, I think it gets to Representative Delta's point, too, is they really do are able to look at the state fresh, because they don't, well, we live in, and I can tell you the boundaries of my district very well, as we can all, but as we know, other citizens can't. And they don't live in that same environment that we do of knowing where these boundaries are and aren't, but they do know a community of interest when they see one. And that's why I think that is the spirit of the bill before you, is really to get that discussion into that environment that can find communities of interest, marry those communities, and create legislative districts. And I think nationally, as we looked at it, it hasn't been perfect, but it's been an improvement upon the process. And that's what the amendments before you do, and we can accept the dash fours. Would prefer not, but could accept them if that's what's needed to move the bill.
So, Chair, may I follow? Would it trouble you if that said in that Section 9, which you have another crack at it in the Senate, we get it, Section 9 that said should be adopted by the Legislative Assembly and signed by the Governor?
Because
if that doesn't happen, then it goes to the Supreme Court, as it says, which certainly seemed to me to strengthen the bill.
Mm-hmm. Susie, who does not like to testify, Mr. Chair, is furiously writing me notes because she does not enjoy testifying in committees, although she's worked harder on this bill. No, it would not. That would not trouble me at all, because I really think the commission is where the action is, and so I would be happy to look at that in the state Senate if that's helpful.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalton.
Could I just sort of react to that, the comment?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. I guess my only reaction, Representative, is the reinforcement plan is a plan that affects the legislature. It's driven by the legislature. It's to involve the executive branch would be to involve an additional layer of politics in this measure, when we're trying to remove the politics from this measure by putting in an independent commission, at least from my perspective. So I am sort of ambivalent about the opportunity for the executive to participate in that, but I certainly wouldn't prefer it.
Mr. Chair, if I may, some people think this isn't about the legislature, but it's about the people. And in a sense, the balance of power is there. I mean, if you cannot get something that both parties agree on, it goes to the Supreme Court anyway. So, I mean, that's chapter, section, sub 10 takes care of that. But it seems to me that all our laws are made. We don't have the authority to deal with important issues just as the legislature. They're all a balance between the legislature and the governor.
But we have a referee in this case, and the referee is the Supreme Court.
In either way we phrase 9, we have the referee in 10.
Thank you.
appreciate the discussion. It would be my prerogative, Senator Decker, which accounts for very little, as you can tell by my committee's bantering back and forth, that the governor not be involved, because I think that it gets away, regardless if it's a Republican or a Democrat governor, I think it gets away from that spirit that you're trying to invoke here, that says the legislature, with Republicans and Democrats representatives of the people, are deciding, going to the judges of the Supreme Court to battle this out as well, without an executive supreme, I am the final rule, which I think is the spirit of what you're getting at. Well, I respect and respectfully disagree with Representative Greenlick on that. This committee will not be making any amendments to the amendments at this time. If the Senate so chooses that, then I would encourage the members of this committee that see that as a fitting touch to this piece of legislation to lobby that on the Senate side for an amendment. At this time, the chair will entertain a motion to move the Dash 4 amendments into HJR 39.
Mr. Chair.
You're in work session.
Huh?
In work session.
We are in work session.
Mr. Chair, I make a motion to accept the Dash 4 amendments into House Joint Resolution 39.
Representative Farr moves to amend HJR 39 with the Dash 4 amendments. Is there any discussion? Seeing none? So done. Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Joint Resolution 39 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, or with a due adopt recommendation.
As amended. Representative Farr moves HJR 39 as amended to the floor. Is it with a due adopt or due pass?
It's an adopt.
With a due adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've seen a lot of research on commissions. There are a lot of imperfections in commissions, as there are imperfections in legislators. I'm not being immune from that. I think the legislature should have first shot at this. I would have supported the Dash 3s. I support the Dash 4s out of deference to my good colleague from Salem here. But I cannot support the resolution. I just want to put that on the record. I think we're solving a problem that with another problem.
Thank you, Representative March, for your comments. Seeing no further,
Annette,
where
did you come?
Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Farr.
Aye.
Representative
Holby.
No.
Representative
March.
No.
Aye. HJR 39 will move to the floor with the due adopt recommendation. Representative Farr, would you like to carry that bill?
I would be delighted, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Decker, for your patience. Sorry, I know you were trying to be added by two. Go back to the top, and we're going to get done with HJR 20, and then we'll go to HB 2583 next. So we'll open a public hearing on HJR 20. Please pass that out. Do you know if Representative Gray Smith or Representative Hansen was wanting to testify on this?
This is Representative Hansen's assistant.
Okay.
Everyone has their
rules. Could you read a summary, please?
Mr. Chair, committee. HR 20 urges Governor's Office to apply the Commission on Presidential Debates to be enable Portland to host the 2008 general election and presidential debate. There is a Dash 1 amendment which changes Portland to Oregon.
Thank you. A little territorial around here. Please state your name for the record and testify on HJR 20.
Thank you. My name is Mark Kirkmar. I'm the legislative assistant for Representative Gary Hansen. He's asked me to read the statement. A United States presidential debate is one of the largest and most prestigious international forums in the world. As with the Olympic Games, it only happens every 4 years. that such a debate would be the most nationally and internationally publicized single-day event that Oregon has ever hosted, eclipsing, I think most historians would say, the opening day of the 1905 Oregon Lewis and Clark Exposition and the 1959 Centennial. The debate sponsoring Commission on Presidential Debates in Washington, D.C. reports that more than 2,000 national and international journalists representing the largest news organizations in the United States, Europe, and Asia have covered every recent presidential and vice presidential debate. Oregon can be one of those sites in just 3 years. This would be the first time a presidential debate has ever been held in the five-state Pacific Northwest or north of San Francisco. The immediate economic benefits to our hotel and hospitality industry, and it would be a long-term opportunity to showcase Oregon issues and products to the world. This is something we're planning for. My legislative assistant, Mark Kirkmeyer, helped manage the University of Portland's application to host a 2000 George Bush versus Albert Gore presidential debate, and he could answer any questions you might have about the debate application process, the opportunities, and why it's important for Oregon to begin taking steps now.
Thank you. I appreciate you being here, Mark, and testifying on behalf of Representative Hansen. Representative March.
Thank you. And Mark, I know you did a lot of work on that, and we almost got there. I assume the dash ones are from both Representatives Hansen and Smith.
Yes.
And they're supporting those. And
yes, they are.
Well, I would put on record that I'm glad to see that they are including all of Oregon, that I wouldn't want it just to be for that small town of Portland.
That's right.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Representative Farr.
Thank you. And, Mark, I also want to thank you for your work, because we would love to host the debate in Eugene.
As a Eugene native myself, I think, however, Representative, it's unrealistic. We learned in 2000 that the Commission on Presidential Debates, bottom line criteria of theirs is that they want sites near an international airport, like within 50 miles away. Salem might have a chance. Also, they want a host city that probably has at least 2,000 to 4,000 first-class hotel rooms.
Mr. Yeah. Chair?
They're going to Hillsborough.
Any place in the Portland metropolitan area would be a serious contender for this. Yes.
We have direct flights from San Francisco to Eugene, so it'd be pretty easy.
Thank you, Representative Farr. Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, I really do want to know whether the amendment is a feel-good amendment or whether, in fact, that I tried to reach conventions other times, and trying to line up 2,000 to 4,000 first-class hotel rooms is really means the Portland metro area is, in fact, the only place to have it.
23 of the last 24 presidential or vice presidential debates have been in cities the size of Portland or larger. One exception was the 2000 vice presidential debate, which is at Center College in Danville, Kentucky, which is about an hour drive out of Louisville, roughly comparable of Portland to Salem. The state of Oregon's best candidate in this would be a metropolitan Portland site.
And I think that we're trying to draw to the Pacific Northwest and to the state of Oregon, not to Portland, which is why this is
right,
getting hearing now and been prior.
The 90-minute debate might actually be within the Portland metropolitan area, but the benefit to the statewide and regional.
Sure. Thank you. We are in work session. Representative March.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to HJR 20.
No? I'm sorry. I
get you opened a hearing.
Public hearing. I apologize. Bouncing back and forth.
I'll
close the public hearing on HJR 20. I'll open a work session on HJR 20.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move the dash one amendments to HJR 20.
Representative March moves the dash one amendments to HJR 20. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
I object.
Representative Greenlee objects, and that you please call the roll.
Representative Yazoo.
Excused.
Representative Farns.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
No.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Marks.
Aye.
Representative
Hatcher. Aye.
Chair votes aye. Dash ones are accepted.
Representative March.
I would move House Joint Resolution 20 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation or do pass recommendation.
As amended.
As amended.
Representative March moves H.J.R. 20 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Do adopt.
Recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Anetta? Excuse.
Aye.
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 Aye. Votes aye. HGR 20 will go to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Representative Hansen and Representative G. Smith will be co-carriers. Committee, we will open a public hearing on HB 2583.
Okay. Public hearing on this?
Public hearing will be very limited, I assure you. After nine public hearings, people don't know this bill by now. Seven.
Eight public hearings.
Plus
two discussions.
Plus today. Seven plus one. Mike, I'm not a genius, Portland State grad, but...
We did have multiple meetings.
Great. At this time, I'm going to call forward panels. We'll have two panels. It looks like there's two people here to testify for it and three people here to testify against it. So the two people that are here to testify for it can come forward at the same time, Ruth Bendel and Mike Balanese.
Please state your name for the record.
Do you want to speak first? Do I go ahead?
Yes,
go ahead.
President Sessions, before we get started, could I have you suspend the rules and allow me to vote on the last bill? President Kitts, just clear that. Do you know how to do that?
Here, help me out, please.
Occupy these for a moment so I can get those up for.
Go with these for a moment, thank you. It's a simple motion.
Yes. Yeah, I just want
Representative March could probably make it.
Madam Chair.
We have to come back in.
Okay.
Are we come back in?
We're back online.
Madam Chair, I would move we suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing Representative Dalto to vote on House Joint Resolution 20.
Okay. Any objections? Okay. Hearing none.
Hearing none.
Representative Dalto, how do you vote?
Dalto votes aye on HJR 20.
Thank you.
Okay. Reopen the work session.
Okay. Reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2583.
Yes. My name is Ruth Bendel, 10980 Southwest Muirwood Drive, Portland 97225. I do have testimony to turn in. I'd like to start out by saying that a newspaper article in the Oregonian yesterday about the situation in Washington State makes it clear how important it is that we determine whether people are eligible electors and have proof of citizenship before an election and when they register to vote, because the state's Superior Court in Washington State excluded in the list of illegal votes in the governor's race the two votes that came from illegal immigrants, people who did not have the right to be electors. And it seems to me that that could set a precedent that it would be senseless not to get the proof of citizenship when people register to vote. In fact, it would make it that Oregon would be a target for people who wanted to vote illegally, by virtue of the fact that if you only can find it out later, if you're going to contest an election, it's going to be an invalid finding. That's number one. Number two, I would like to remind people that vote by mail is an anonymous way for people to both register and to cast their vote, so that there is no way, unless we require proof of citizenship and require proof of identity, which goes along with it, that we are ever going to not have any data showing whether somebody is eligible as an elector. We already have found out from our neighboring state how many ineligible electors, due to, in part, the propensity for vote by mail in absentee voting in Washington State, we've already seen how many ineligible voters have voted in just one county alone, 1,000. That, if you spread it out over several counties, can sway the outcome and dilute the value of any person's vote and just makes elections a mockery. I'd also like to remind this committee that back in the 80s, we had the Rajneesh take over...
Antelope.
Take over the city of Antelope.
We've heard that, Ruth.
Yes. And, yes, we did. And it made people sufficiently concerned that they ran to sign a petition that required a 21-day cutoff. So that what could happen? So that people's eligibility as an elector would, there would be time to find that out with that 21-day cutoff. We don't have those kinds of safeguards today. People turn in a voter registration card by mail, for the most part, and there is nothing except their trust in what they have put on that voter registration card, which is precious little. Their name, their address, their date of birth, which may or may not be true, and they have the option to give a mailing address. And unless that any subsequent correspondence, including a ballot, is returned as undeliverable if people use a mailing address, a residence address, they're not disqualified. If they use a mailing address, which can be anywhere, a P.O. box, they are going to get that ballot whether they live at that residence or not. And we do ask people to affirm at the bottom of that registration that they have told the truth and that it's a felony. But if you don't check and you don't verify, this is an invitation to adversaries and opponents to take advantage of the lack of the safeguards. And that's what's happened in Washington State and undoubtedly has happened in other places. We had 2 9/11 terrorists who certainly were not eligible to vote that used voter ID cards to gain access to flight training school. Trust but verify. And we have lost the verify aspect in Oregon. I urge you to pass HB 2583. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth. Michael, good to see you.
Chair Kitts, members of the committee, I feel like I know each one of you intimately. While you traveled around the state, I listened to the archive testimony 3 and 4 times and took notes. So I'm not going to rehash prior testimony. I just want to bring up a couple of things, and then I'll reminisce for just a second, if you'd allow me. Something that kind of makes me wonder what the motives of the chief opponents are. Prior to the vote...
I have a problem with that statement. I don't think it's proper testimony to be dealing with the motives of opponents in this bill.
I'd
be happy to deal with motives of the proponents as well, but I don't think that's proper.
I think that's fair. I think if you have objections or if you'd like to clarify,
that's fine.
If something's been misstated, then please feel free to
that's clarify.
Thanks, Mike.
That's fine. Prior to the passage of vote by mail, the initiative petition contained no date signed by line. The vote by mail petition did not include that. Now it does. And so someone who signs an initiative petition can be disenfranchised by a date signed being either after or before. So I think that when we're talking about the seriousness of elections, I think it's just as serious as an initiative petition being filled in correctly. I'm just making a point. Back in North Plains, I mentioned that in Arizona, Prop 200 passed. I would imagine it would be considered overwhelmingly. It passed the court test. It is constitutional and in place in Arizona. So there is precedent for our bill, for our concept. We are not making something up that has not already been proven in court. Now, just to reminisce for just a minute. I was quite taken by the hearing down in Florence. Our bill was like a piñata. It got beat up. It got beat up pretty good. Except there was a couple of people that came in and said, the registration system the way it is today, it's too easy. It's been devalued. You heard all the no's, and most of the no's were from people who worked voter registration drives. And when they work voter registration drives, they want to make it as easy as possible. That's what I heard, as easy as possible for people to vote. So before anybody asks today, yes, I did bring my passport. I don't carry it around with me. I did not find it troubling that on a couple days' notice that I knew of this hearing to go and get it. Proof of live birth, right there with it. That is in our bill, birth certificate. I don't have naturalization papers because I was born in San Francisco.
You sure?
I'm not going to enter my birth certificate into the record, but yes.
Sure. Thank you.
May I just add one thing?
Ruth, if it's something that we haven't heard in the previous seven testimonies, absolutely.
Okay, I don't know what you heard in the other seven testimonies. I didn't keep a record of it, but I would like to. Yes, well, I would like to say that with the impending centralized voter registration system, I think, and as does the rest of the country, get with the momentum for the Real ID bill that's going before the U.S. Senate very shortly and is expected to pass. I do not believe that the federal government wants to give Oregon $18 million for a centralized voter registration system where absolutely no tracking data is going to be entered into that system, and simply people who are currently on the electoral roll who did not give proof of citizenship, did not give any kind of identity proof whatever, are going to just be shoveled into that system. I believe that it is absolutely an imperative that this committee start the ball rolling by getting proof of citizenship through, and also that the funding would be tied to the requirement to have proof of citizenship and tracking data, whether it's the social security number or the driver's license or both, so that we don't have taxpayers paying $18 million for a system that simply cannot do the task that it's designed to do. Thank you for giving me the extra time.
You bet, Ruth. Representative March.
I'm sorry.
Ruth, quit interrupting Mike.
Also, in Florence, the thing that struck me is that a man came in and essentially accused this committee of having your minds made up. And Representative Dalto rightfully was indignant, rather forcefully indignant about that. So even though I have a pretty good idea of how the committee has been from day one, just hunches, I would never have taken that position. And that was from a gentleman who opposed our bill. So he seemed to think that this committee had their mind made up in a favorable fashion. Ruth talked to you about the Real ID bill. I think that a lot of objections that we've heard to this bill and the two prior attempts in the last two sessions will be rectified and made a lot easier when the Real ID bill passes and President Bush signs it, that the Oregon driver's license will then be available to register to vote. So state fairs, rock concerts, and let's see, other students who come in from out of state, etc., will be able to use their driver's license. So we do have a movement that is coming that will make 2583 very manageable. And I guess finally, your last stop in Medford, I was very pleased to hear a man who came from Klamath Falls who had an opportunity to either go to a Ways and Means Committee hearing that was being held that Saturday in Klamath Falls, and he chose to come to Medford and testify in favor of House Bill 2583. That, despite all the beating that our bill took from the same people along the trail, I think vindicates what I'm going to finish by saying, is that if we did an initiative instead of coming before you in Oregon like Arizona did, our informal polling right now says that this bill, if in measure form, would pass easily 60%, probably closer to 70%. Our polling is not formal. It's informal. But it's over the course of years. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. Representative Mark.
Thank you. And I appreciate, Ruth, your testimony about the two non-citizens in Washington State, a state that's like double our size. But this question actually is for Mike. Mike, in reviewing the testimony we heard in Medford, you probably heard that a bigger problem from the county clerk, Kathy Beckett, was regarding paid signature gatherers, and they had a number of, I think they had 300 bad registrations based on the paid signature gatherers, the bounty system. Do you have any comments about that?
Chair Kitts, Representative March. Are you talking about the initiative?
No, this was registered voters.
Registered voters?
Bounties paid for registered voters.
Registrations.
Right.
Yeah.
I personally would like to see registration drives done by volunteers and done in a not a formal setting, but certainly not out on the street, rock concert type thing. I think it's a little bit more serious and should be done more professionally. So, bounty hunter, yeah, I would agree that probably is a problem.
Okay. Thank you.
May I say something on that? As long as there is no proof sought from anybody, and anybody out there can be standing out there, whether it's a volunteer or otherwise, I think that voter registration is far too serious to be done and to have registrations brought in, and I quote some of the county clerks, by the bucket load, and there is no requirement for proof of ID, and we have an act that says that people should be submitting proof of ID when they register to vote. So to have anonymous people, and certainly in Oregon, that requirement was only made for people who registered by mail. No, I do not support it. Whether it's bounty hunters or volunteers, this is a formal process. It's a serious process.
I think you're right. Thank you.
And I'm an immigrant. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth. Thank you, Mike. I see Representative Anderson and Flores have joined us and are wishing to testify. I believe both of them are in favor of the bill, so I can figure and bring both of them up at the same time.
Representative Flores would like me to go first, but I think beauty before age, don't you?
No comment.
Oh. Yeah. It's a good way to get an adjournment real quick.
I'm Representative Gordon Anderson from District 3, and Mr. Chair and members, thank you for hearing this bill. The reason I'm here is basically to affirm my strong support for the bill. I have a parallel House Bill 2841, that is pretty much the same language, but I'm going to defer and hopefully sign on with 2583. I think we all feel that it's a privilege to vote in this country. It's an honor. And I think I personally feel that we have dropped the limits a little bit to that privilege and honor. And I think it's time we regain some of the area that we've lost. Yes, everybody who's qualified should vote. We should go out and seek them on the streets. We should try and bring them in, but they must be qualified. I think you've heard that all over the state. And I certainly hear it in my area strongly. It is not too hard to get a birth certificate. I think we heard in Grants Pass that, well, that might cost $40. Is the restriction of $40 too much for a person who wants to become a citizen of the state and nation and vote? I don't think so. I think we spend $40 on candy. And for the privilege for a lifetime to vote, to get your birth certificate validated and or a copy of it is not too much to ask. To produce the naturalization documents that you must have gone through to become a citizen, you got them. Just produce them. And then a valid passport. Most of the folks that have been coming back and forth across the border, some of them, I shouldn't say most, but some of them already have passports. That's not a problem. So really what we're talking about is those people who are unwilling to take the step to show that they are certified to vote. Those are the people that we want to exclude and welcome them as soon as they're willing to go through the steps to become like you or I as a citizen of this country. So I encourage you to pass this bill to the floor, and I hope that it'll pass right through the Senate and the governor's hands and become law of the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Linda Flores. I'm state representative for House District 51, which is Clackamas, Damascus, Boring, and Cicada. Damascus, the newest city in the state of Oregon, since Kaiser 22 years ago. I, too, am here to indicate my support for House Bill 2583. I would like to express to you a concern that I hear from time to time for those who oppose this bill, and that is that this is an effort to disenfranchise voters. I cannot heartily disagree more. This is an effort to provide the accurate and true documentation for those people who are eligible and entitled to vote in this state. It seems that whenever the issue of voting, modifying the voting process procedure comes to the fore, that is an argument that is without doubt brought forward. This is an effort to disenfranchise voters. That is not the case. It is an effort to validate those who have the right to be voting here. So I simply come forward to reiterate that and would hope that you would consider that in your deliberations and as you move forward, and certainly would love to encourage your I vote to pass this on for consideration, debate on the floor, and move it forward. Thank you very much. Be happy to answer any questions should there be any.
Thank you for your testimony. Seeing none, thank you very much.
I would just say, Mr. Chair, I gave a plug for Kaiser. You missed it.
She said you were old. Oh, I disagree vehemently. At this time, we'll call forward the three people that we have that are opposing the bill. Andy Miller. You did. No, you're right. You're right. And I have that note somewhere right around here. I can't read your handwriting, so if you can just come forward and say it for the record.
I'm sorry.
That'd be great.
I'm Dr. Sylvia Zook, a local resident since 1977. In 1987, I was campaign manager for the 20-day voter registration cutoff. And we worked extremely hard to get that measure on the ballot with record purity of petition signers. It was during that campaign that it was discovered, in fact it was proven, that anyone could register their dog to vote in this state. And it would probably be even easier today, given what we saw in the last national campaign, to anybody who could get across the borders, essentially, in this country can now vote. And they don't even have to get across the borders anymore with absentee voting. In fact, the media reported during that campaign in one county there were more votes than there were residents in the county. And the this whole issue I am passionately concerned about. I hope that our state can be a leader in this effort to return meaning to voting, for which so many died. And I thank you for considering this whole issue. I wasn't here for the 7 or 8 previous hearings. I didn't know anything about that until last night. I learned about this particular thing, this particular hearing today. And I urge you to vote yes on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor, for your testimony.
By the way, I'm in the middle of a move, and I just took off and ran down here, so I'm not dressed to testify, but I feel so strongly about this, I had to be here.
Thank you. Appreciate you taking the time to come down here. At this time, we'll call forward Andy Miller, Eduardo Angulo, I don't know if I'm saying that correctly or not, and Cappy Eaton. And in the sake of time, I will say to you folks who have been here for the previous 7 as well, with representatives of your organizations, if it's nothing new, then please don't say it, because the committee will shoot me, and I will need to borrow Mike Balanese's passport to get out of the country. So, thank you.
Are you ready?
Yep.
Members of the committee, Chair Kitz, my name is Andy Miller. I'm the executive director of Con and Cause Oregon. I don't want to be tedious. I'm going to read my testimony. I was not able to present this testimony in North Plains when I was trying to get the opportunity. I spoke privately with most of you, and with Chair Kitz in particular. I think you know how I feel about this bill. I want to put it on the public record. While it's important that only eligible voters are allowed to vote, it is also important that political parties and other advocates not engage in activities such as systematic and arbitrary challenging of voters intended to intimidate voters and disrupt elections. This bill is a solution looking for a problem. It is an attempt to suppress voting by making it more difficult to register to vote. This will be a particular problem for young people who were born in another state. I cite as an example my efforts to obtain a birth certificate for my son who was born in Illinois. We were applying for passports, and fortunately I'd allowed enough time. It took well over a month for me to get the birth certificate from Illinois. Many voter registration drives take place close to elections. We complain about the lack of participation by young people, but if we make it more difficult or impossible to register within a tight time frame, how have we helped them to become more involved? And how many of you carry your birth certificate and passport with you at all times? The voter registration form, and I gave you all one of these, lists qualifications first. If you check no in response to either of these questions, you are told not to complete the form. Signature box leads with, "I swear, affirm that I'm qualified to be an elector and I have told the truth on this registration." Below the signature is a red bar with the words, "Warning, if you sign this card and know it is false, you can be fined up to $100,000 and or jailed for up to 5 years. These are adequate safeguards and preclude the necessity for evidence of citizenship or age. This bill has had overwhelming opposition and testimony across the state. This is a bad bill. We urge you not to give it any further consideration.
Thank you.
Chair Kitz, members of the committee, and it's my understanding that, for the record, my name is Cappy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. My understanding was that our representative at North Plains also was unable to speak and did file testimony. For that reason, I'm simply going to highlight a couple of the points that we really want to leave with you as you make a decision about this bill.
Kathy, I was saying that even if your person did not get a chance to testify at the Committee on North Plains, I think this committee will attest that League Room voters have had participation in every one of the seven, now eight, public hearings, and I have also submitted testimony from you yourself the first time that it was here. So
that's correct.
Thank you.
First of all, I want to say that HAPAA does not require additional identification, and we are under the Help America Vote Act. County election officials have full authority to question and not to accept a person seeking to register if there's any doubt about the validity of that request. The League believes that every citizen should be encouraged to register to vote and that the process should be accessible, efficient, and simple. House Bill 2583 would make it less accessible and more complicated. This is the opposite of the result sought by HAVA, which attempts to make the whole process of elections more open and user-friendly, particularly for the disabled, minorities, and young people. The League believes it should be the policy of the state to encourage voting, not to construct roadblocks to the registration process. HB 2583 should not be enacted. Thank you.
Happy. Does the League have a position about the fact that if, in fact, somebody on this registration form, you need to provide, and sign all the stuff that, you've mentioned, that you need to provide, I'm just going to read it, sufficient identification is a copy of one of the following showing your current name and address, : valid photo identification, parentheses, such as a driver's license, a paycheck stub, a utility bill, a bank statement, a government document. But if, in fact, you vote in a federal election, you don't have to provide any one of those things. Does that have a problem?
That's a federal law. That's a federal voting act over which we have no control. No. But we have, we believe we have sufficient identification requirements for the state.
Perfect. Thank you. Yeah. See no further questions. Is Eduardo? Not here?
Yes,
please. Oh, he had to leave? If you're friends of his, please extend my apologies. All right. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2583? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2583 and open a work session on House Bill 2583. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Governor Green.
Thank you. I've lived in this country long enough, simply through longevity, to get a sense of the American people. And I've learned to have a fair amount of confidence and trust in the American people. I think when somebody signs a form and says that under penalty of felony punishment, they're a citizen and they're eligible to vote, I have confidence enough to know that that's good enough for me. We heard testimony in Florence, I believe, about how easy it was to buy false identification, false birth certificates, a variety of things. The extent to which that's true, what we have are miscreants being able to falsify their citizenship if they so desire, if they want to fly an airplane into a building. But citizens being restricted from a right because they don't have documentation available. And I really do want to reiterate as strongly as possible that with the Voting Rights Act of 65, we established the principle that voting is not a privilege in the United States. We use voting as a privilege throughout our history to disenfranchise people. But that voting act made clear that voting is a right. I think we need to do everything we can to protect that right. I don't impugn the motives of the people proposing this legislation.
Nor would I allow you.
I don't think that they're attempting to disenfranchise any groups of our population. But what I do think is a result of this bill, they will disenfranchise large populations of our citizens, young people who who don't have birth certificates handy, a variety of other people. And I think for any single person that they'll stop, 2 out of 3 million in Washington in the last election, there'll be thousands of American citizens that will be disenfranchised. Citizens who have a right to vote and citizens for whom we have an obligation to make that right operational. I think this bill is a disaster, and I think it's something we really need to stop.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I just had an observation. I went to the Mexican consulate yesterday, and one of the things I got out of that meeting was the incredible process they go through in Mexico to get registered to vote in light of all the fraudulent elections that they'd had down there. And it takes them 2 months to get a... I'm not saying it's copied. I'm just saying it's very important. They cleaned up the system. They have... they have to prove their residency. They have to prove their citizenship. They have to show a passport, which means they have to show a birth certificate, as I understand it. They have to give a thumbprint on their car. It has biometric features on it, security features on it. And I was rather impressed with the lengths that they went through in that country to protect the integrity of their system. And here we are, the United States of America, beacon to the world, yet a huge target in the world as well. And to protect that process, that very fundamental right, it baffles me that we wouldn't want to protect that. And that's all that my intentions are in supporting this bill.
Thank you, Representative Thatcher. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just wanted to comment. I'm going to be voting no on this bill. I traveled to, I think, seven out of the eight committee hearings on this bill, and the testimony from the public was overwhelmingly against this bill. I think of the ones I kept track of, 2 out of 10 was the best that proponents of this bill did in gaining support of this bill, just from the testimony I've heard. And further, there was really a lack of any evidence that there's abuse of our voting system the way it is. And I sincerely, am worried about disenfranchising voters and limiting the ability of people who deserve and have the right to vote and limiting them from being able to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Holby. Representative Dalto.
Mr. Chair, my vote is a courtesy vote to get it to the House floor.
Thank you, Representative Dalto. Seeing no further discussion, Annette? Oh, Representative Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2583 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thatcher moves House Bill 2583 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Seeing that we've already had all of our discussion. Annette.
Aye.
Representative
Barnes.
Aye.
No.
Representative Holby.
No.
Representative
Marks.
No.
Representative
Sanders.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2583.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to serve notice that we'll have a possible minority report on this bill. Thank you.
Good. So noted. House Bill 2583 will move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Holby served notice of possible minority reports, and Representative Flores will carry this bill. Thank you. This time I'll open a work session on 2614. Oh, okay. I'm still going to open a work session on 2614. Cletus, do you want to read the summary on House Bill 2614?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2614 prohibits electors from participating in more than one nominating process for each partisan public office to be filled at a general election.
Thank you, Cletus. Colleagues, this is Representative Nolan's and myself, our bill. Nolan and myself, not Nolan's. Nolan and myself. Thank you. Bill that would do just what Cletus said. We've had a public hearing on it.
If my colleagues have any further questions on this bill, I'm more than happy to turn over the gavel to one of my vice chairs and take questions, as I'm sure Representative Nolan is. If not, Chair would entertain a motion to move 2614.
Mr. Chair, I move 2614 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Greenlich moves House Bill 2614 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think during the discussion I mentioned some... I'm a little concerned about the people who maybe didn't vote in the primary and then they're changing parties and then they're kind of locked out of the process. But I will give a courtesy vote to get it to the floor and let the floor make the decision on it. I may not vote for it on the floor, but I just wanted to give you that courtesy.
Thank you for your courtesy, Representative March. Any further discussion? Seeing none.
Annette?
Thank you, Alton.
I believe Representative Greenlich made the motion. Okay.
Votes aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2614 will move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Nolan and myself will co-carry the bill. Thank you. What's that? We'll now open a work session on House Bill 3302. Cletus, would you please read House Bill 3302?
Mr. Chair and Committee, House Bill 3302 directs Secretary of State to print measure arguments in state voters' pamphlet and order arguments are filed and without any title designating whether argument supports or opposes measure.
Thank you, Cletus.
We do have a dash to amendment that has been received by committee.
We do have a dash to amendment that has been received by committee. Representative Farr, is the dash to amendment your amendment?
The dash to amendment actually was filed by Bill Northrup along with the help of the Secretary of State's office.
So it's your desire that we move the dash to amendment into 3302?
Yes, it is.
We're in work session.
All right. Would you entertain a motion?
I'm in work session.
Mr. Chair, I move that we accept a dash two amendments in House Bill 3302.
Representative Farr moves dash two amendments into House Bill 3302. Any discussion? Seeing none, Representative Farr.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3302 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Farr moves House Bill 3302 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any objection? Seeing none. Annette.
Aye.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
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 Votes aye. House Bill 3302, receiving the affirmative, will move to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Committee will stand at ease for 1 second. We have an LC. LC 3047 introduced as a committee bill. Colleagues, you've all seen 3047 in your packet. Representative Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 3047 be drafted as a committee bill.
Representative Thatcher moves LC 3047 be drafted as a committee bill. Any discussion?
Another tax credit, Mr. Chair?
You said it. I was thinking it.
Any objection?
Yes, I'll object this time, sir.
Thank you. Annetta, will you please call the roll?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Excuse.
Aye. No. First.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. LC 3047 will be drafted as a committee bill. Thank you.
My colleague calls me doctor now.
That's all right. Anything else for the good of the order? No. 3 o'clock, 2 hours, good committee. Adjourned.
Mr. Chair, may I...